Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, it's all poetry all the time. Later in the hour, I'll talk with poet Seth Thill, who is also an assistant at the Waterloo Public Library. We'll talk about making poetry accessible and exciting to new audiences. But first, Paul Brook is a man of many talents. He is a scientist, a photographer, a poet, a powerlifter, and professor of English and endowed chair of creative writing at Grandview University. He has just published his sixth book of poetry. It's a collection that brings together many of his passions. It's called Pantagruelian, Photographs and Poems of Torres del Paine. He is also the editor of the newly published The Cities of the Plains, an anthology of Iowa artists and poets. And he will be all over the place at Poetry Palooza in Des Moines, which takes place on Friday and Saturday at Grandview University. And he's with me now. Hello, Paul.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for coming back to the show. And Paul, you are a man who has pursued many different pathways in life. When did you discover poetry?
Well, I was in college at Iowa State, and I had published one poem in Lyrical Iowa, and back in, 1986, I think. And that began my journey. So that's what started it. And then I ended up getting my master's and PhD after getting my undergraduate degree in fisheries and wildlife biology. So, yeah.
Did you resist the pull of poetry and that creative direction?
I think I did at first. And then once I got into class and realized that maybe I had a knack for it, I kind of broke free of that. But yeah, I took some guff from some of my buddies, and they didn't quite understand what I was doing, but I didn't quite care, so it was fine.
Did you understand what you were doing?
No.
All right. So take me a little bit further along that journey. I mean, what was so irresistible to you?
I think I'm certainly drawn to language, and I love exploring words and, figuring out places and traveling. And so it just made sense to me that I would find a way to articulate that and then to keep throwing myself in new situations that refresh that experience, right? So poetry, I don't want it to be stagnant. I don't want it to be the same old thing. I want it to invigorate folks and make them feel something or take them to a place that transports them. And that's a challenge. So I'm always trying to reinvent the wheel every book I do.
Who are your influences? What were you reading that was inspiring you to try your own hand at creation?
Well, early on, it was Gary Snyder and Mary Oliver, and they were the two that spoke to me in terms of the natural world. And Gary Snyder came and visited Ames when he was much younger, and I got to meet him, and it was super helpful. But also to see, like, he went through the whole Beat movement, and he was true to himself. He thought about Buddhist philosophy. So he had this way of presenting himself that was very centered, and I really appreciated that. So I was drawn to that idea.
You've shared a story in past interviews about a really kind of traumatic experience that you had that also made you think, I need to pursue this creative pathway in life. And that was when you witnessed an accident. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, we were coming back from Minnesota, up in Minneapolis, and I was working as an administrator at the time, and it was terrible. The van flipped over, I don't know how many times, and I pulled this young girl out of the wreckage and held her in my arms as the ambulance came. I didn't know if she was gonna make it. And I had this revelation at that moment that I was not doing the work I should be doing, that I'd been pulled away from it, and it was bad for my psyche. And so the weird part was they took her away, and I never knew if she lived or died. I couldn't contact the hospital to ask who. I didn't know her name. I'm assuming she's okay, but I don't know. And it was just like I remember I had a new jacket and had blood all over it, and I was just like, it just completely recalibrated everything for me. So, yeah.
Well, tell me more about how that changed your thinking. Like, it made you think I'm doing the wrong job.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people who may even enjoy poetry, mm-hmm. that idea that it is essential to you, that it is what you absolutely had to be doing with your life, may be a little bit difficult to understand. Tell me more about what changed for you.
Well, I think you realize what's important, right? I mean, of course, it's family and it's connection, but it's also doing things that make you feel like you live. And so I felt like I was not doing the thing that gave me the most pleasure and joy, which was, you know, writing and being out there and sharing that with people. And so all of a sudden, it made me refocus and think differently about how I was approaching my own life.
Did it change how you wrote?
It did. I mean, I think I always shied away from confessionalism. It's always hidden in my work. I think it came out more after that happened. I think there was more revelation there. I think there was also more vulnerability. And I think that was a turning point for me.
I mentioned some of the many things that you do because it is represented in your work, but also I think it's so remarkable that you have been able to pursue multiple pathways at the same time. I mean, you are a professor of English at Grandview. You also have published all of these books of poetry, but just yesterday, you announced that you've been elected to the board of directors for the North American Nature Photographers Association, and you have pursued this scientific path and this wildlife photography at the same time. Tell me more about that part of your life.
Well, I'm interested in interdisciplinary studies. I'm interested in spanning disciplines, and I feel like when you do that, people are more intrinsically interested in what that is, and they also have other handholds in understanding the work. So when I show, you know, images and then I talk about pumas, people are like, oh my gosh, you were that close, or oh my gosh, they're so beautiful, I never knew. And then I read the poems and it's more transcendent. It becomes more visceral and important to them. And it's more moving. So I feel like if I can be charged up and do and approach things from multiple ways and different ways of seeing, then I think that I unlock a little bit more mystery for my viewers or for my readers.
Have you had to do a lot of work to convince your colleagues that it's okay for you to disappear to Chile for, I don't know how long, but you've got some incredible photographs, so you must have spent a lot of time there. How do you make the case for all of these threads in your life?
Oh, I'm sure they're glad I'm gone, but I'm just kidding, of course. But I mean, I feel like they're all doing their own kinds of things. So I think that we support each other in those moments. And so, yeah, I think it's one of those times when you have to get out and get away and immerse yourself. And once that happens, then you're changed. And I think that's the world of poetry, right? You want to read a poem and be transported. I want to go somewhere and be transported and then bring that back and then transport people. So it's a cyclical process.
So this latest book that you've just released, The Pantagruelian Photographs and Poems of Torres del Paine, and that's a national park in Chile. And this book features photographs that you took at Torres del Paine. So tell me a little bit about the time that you have spent there.
Well, you know, we're on the ground, get out early in the morning, and then there were times when we were spending 9 hours with one puma. One day I followed one for 10 kilometers. She was hunting, and I'm telling you, like, you think, oh, I'm in good shape. No, you're not. I mean, these things are just they're so evolved and they're so conditioned to the environment that they just move like effortlessly, like water through the landscape. And so I got back and it was like 10 o'clock and I was like completely fried. And it was just amazing to be that close to something that's hunting and doing its thing, but then also unbothered by us effectively, which was astonishing. Yeah.
How do you get that close?
Well, we have rules, right? We're supposed to be no closer than 80 to 100 feet. But if I'm on the ground and my tripod's set up and one walks by, there's nothing I can do. And so they would often come within 6 feet of us. And it was just, it was magical. I mean, to be that close to something, a predator that really is not hunting you, but it's just just, you're like a rock in the environment, and it's walking by like, oh, you're a rock, you know, whatever. But it changes you. It changes your molecules. It's pretty cool.
You have published not just incredible photographs of pumas, but also jaguars. You seem to have a little bit of a fascination with big cats. Where did that come from?
I have no idea. No, like, it's funny, growing up in Iowa, I never saw a mountain lion. I mean, I've tracked them. I've never seen one. I've got trail cams up. I've never actually got a good photograph of one. So it's like kind of maddening. But I think I'm just interested in, especially for predators, how we coexist with them. And so these two examples are really important because they are coexisting with the people in those regions, right? Jaguars are finding a way to coexist with ecotourism in Brazil. Pumas are doing the same thing in Chile. And so I am fascinated by how that has driven the economy and how people are now starting to accept them. And I'm interested in that historical change in perception. And so that's what really draws me in. It's more about destroying the myth of them for me and presenting a new kind of narrative. I think that's very exciting.
And in this new collection, Pantagruelli, and you not only have pictures of pumas, but you also took a lot of pictures of other species of wildlife living in the park as well. You do seem to have a particular fondness for those predators, though.
Oh, yes, for sure. But I was always a bird guy. I mean, I took classes with Jim Dinsmore at Iowa State, and I was completely smitten with birds. But I think I'm just interested in wildlife, period. And anything I see that is something that I haven't seen before, I'm just excited about. I'm like a kid. So if I get to see a small fox, or if I get to see a skunk, I'm thrilled. I'm also going to keep my distance, but yes. So,
all right, we'll get to some poetry in just a moment. We have to take a short break. I'm talking with Paul Brook. He is professor of English and endowed chair of creative writing at Grandview University. His sixth book of poetry, Pantagruelian, Photographs and Poems of Torres del Paine, has just been published. He's also the editor of the newly published The Cities of the Plains, an anthology of Iowa artists and poets. He'll be doing many things at Poetry Palooza in Des Moines on Friday and Saturday, including their book launch for The Cities of the Plains. That's at 3 p.m. on Saturday at the Speed Lyceum at Grandview University. More in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Hands in Harmony, a therapeutic healthcare facility with a splash of spa and a team of holistic healers to help in the quest for health, harmony, and happiness. Cedar Rapids and Mount Vernon. Classes, massage, and more at myhih.com. This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about poetry. In just about 15 minutes, I will talk with poet Seth Thill, who's also an assistant at the Waterloo Public Library, about making poetry accessible to new audiences. With me right now is Paul Brook. He is a poet. He is professor of English and endowed chair of creative writing at Grandview University. And he has just published his sixth book of poetry. It's a collection that brings together not just poetry, but some of his other passions, nature photography and science among them. It is called Pantagruelian, Photographs and Poems of Torres del Paine. He's also the editor of the newly published The Cities of the Plains, an anthology of Iowa artists and poets. So, Paul, with Pantagruelian, there's a puma on the cover, and I didn't actually read the back of the book before I started reading poems. I found myself a little bit confused, so then I did look at the back of the book, and I thought, oh, now I understand what we're doing here. So tell us a little bit about the idea behind this collection that does bring together your poems and your photographs.
Well, the idea is that there's a woman and she ends up losing everything and she then goes out and lives with pumas. So it's a myth, right? She lives with them and basically becomes one of them in a sense. So she, you know, travels with them and kind of protects them and so forth. So she becomes a kind of arbiter or kind of like protector of the species. And it's really a kind of point of like, we need to protect this species and find a way to keep them safe And that's the point for sure.
You say it's a myth, although mm-hmm. I think of a number of true stories that I've heard in my life of people living with predators, like living with wolves. Have you heard about people who have actually done this?
I mean, sure. I think some of it's overblown, but I mean, yeah, it's possible, I suppose. And these pumas, I mean, the BBC went and did a show, and they lived with one of these pumas for several months, and she became very acclimated. And we ran into her, and she wanted nothing to do with us. She's like, "Oh, you must be like the BBC. Get away from me." So it was like, I mean, literally, she looked at me like, "Just get away." So I saw her hiding in the grass. I was like, "Let's just let her go."
I've had enough of cameras in my lifetime.
I may be famous, but you know, whatever. So I think that they're tolerant that way, but also like they need their space, and you need to be aware of that. So
yes, and if you don't respect a cat that big, I think you're probably very foolish. Can you share a couple of poems from the collection with us?
Absolutely. I'm going to do the first one. Actually, I'm going to do it about flamingos, just because why not? So the Chilean flamingos are just absolutely gorgeous. They have dark underwings. They have these amazing discoloration. And so this poem is it's a Cueca Chilena. It's a form poem from the region, so it's pretty short. And this is called "The Flamingos of the Atacama Desert." "No flamingos," she thought, "survived worse. Endured salt flats, hellish heat, sucked diatoms and boiling water, stirred winter ice with feet, yes, stirred winter ice with feet, and yet brine shrimp bring their colors pink, and at the click of a latch she waited to avoid his cruel words, his reach."
That is Paul Brook reading from Pantagruelian, and we start with the flamingos, and we follow this story through many different species and really incredible photographs. That were the poems driven by the photographs in any way, or did you select the photographs based on the poems?
I'd written a few of them before I went, and then when I came back, I wrote more. I wrote a couple there, but it was hard because I was mostly photographing. I think I took, 10,000 photographs or more. So it was like they kind of go both ways. Like the poem I'm going to read next is called "Season of the Shotgun, Season of the Rifle," and it's a picture of an Austral parakeet, but it has to deal with how so many species there are just shot and killed. And so I felt like, you know, once I saw that photo, when I took that photo, I was like, oh, this is a poem I need to write. So I think it just depends on the situation, but sometimes the photo will bring you a new poem.
Yeah, go ahead and read that one for us.
Okay, cool. And there's two words in here, and they're basically, it's skunks and foxes, if you're not sure what I'm saying. So, "Her father justified each bad deed, leg-trapping chingus, chillas, picking off parakeets from fruit trees, sharpshooting pumas on kills." Yes, sharpshooting pumas on kills. "There was no redemption for his acts, no redaction possible. Puma skins were dried in the old barn and stacked."
Pantagruelian, it's a feast for all the senses. It's just a really beautiful collection, Paul, and completely unique. I have never seen anything like this. Have you seen anything like this?
No.
All right. Well, it's really beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. But we do need to move on to this other big project. I don't know when you sleep. But you have just published an anthology of Iowa artists and poets. It's called The Cities of the Plains. And this is a project that you managed to secure a grant to put together. This was an idea that came to you. Where did it come from?
I was actually driving by my hometown, Eldora, Iowa, and I was thinking about Mona Van Dunn, who was born there, I think. And I think she lived there for a little bit, and then she moved away. And she was poet laureate. She was poet laureate, but she was also a Pulitzer Prize winner and one of the few in the state. I mean, it was pretty exciting. So I just was like, what if we did? I was thinking about a book Michael Carey did in 1996 called Voices on the Landscape, and I really thought we needed a reboot of it. And I also knew that we've got a lot of new talent. We've got a lot of folks out there who haven't really been read, but also a lot of artists. And I really wanted to do my thing of combining art and poetry, because I think there's a good synergy between those two things. And so that's how it was born.
So this book has just beautiful photographs of many different kinds of works of art interspersed with poems. How did you decide who would be included in the collection?
Oh, it was brutal. There were so many poets that sent their work in and so many artists. I started thinking about more groupings of how things would fit together, and then that made the decision a bit easier. But, you know, I had to say no to a lot of people, and it's very painful. And there was some good work out there that didn't get published. But the work we have is really strong, and I think it's an incredible I think it's 70% women. There's just a lot of diverse voices, and I think it's the new set of people that are kind of doing great poetry in the state, and I'm just really pleased to show that.
Not just doing great poetry, but creating art as well. Did you question yourself at any point about including both? You could have included more poetry if you hadn't included art, for example.
No, I felt like aesthetically, I thought it came together pretty nicely in terms of many of the pieces fit. It seemed like they were meant to be together. And so it just sort of all organically matched. And it's kind of miraculous in some ways. But I just started grouping them. And then all of a sudden, I felt like the book had found its shape. And that's how it played.
Yeah, it's also a really beautiful, beautiful collection that the artwork kind of allows you to breathe when you're reading the poetry. Although you can also take your time with the collection if you're not preparing for a talk show. but tell me a little bit, the poets that you chose to include are a diverse group, and there's not necessarily a thread that ties their poetry together. How did you choose what to include?
Well, there was no theme. And I feel like there is a thread of like Iowa throughout it, but then there's also a thread of like it's anything goes. You know, poets are a creative bunch. And so you can't really nail them down and say like, we're going to have a theme of I don't know what land. I mean, that's too generic. But I feel like there was just a variety of different topics and also styles. And that's what I wanted to show, like the diversity of poetry in the state. I think that's what's essential.
As you mentioned, the artwork pairs really well with some of the poems. How did you do that? That must have been a creative process in and of itself to bring those two things together.
Well, I mean, I felt like most of it did snap together. And then I got to the end and I was like, I mean, not at the last minute, moving a few things around. And then I felt like then I found it had found its place. It was a challenge. It took me about a week to design the entire book, like 8 hours a day. By the time I got done, I was like exhausted, but also very happy with the results.
And I think as much as I love the poetry and the artwork, also the collection of biographies in the back of the book is really wonderful because, I mean, so many of these artists, yes, I'm familiar with them, but then I got to know many other artists through this book and I thought, who is that? And then you told me. So do you also consider this? I mean, you said that you feel like these are some of the people who we're going to be hearing more from in the next few years. Do you feel like this is an introduction in some way?
I think so. It was funny because I sent this out as a proof and some of the younger poets were like, can I make my biography bigger? And I'm like, okay. Because they wanted to show like that they matched up to folks who'd been in the field for a while. And so then I felt like then we kind of had a good balance. But yeah, I mean, it's really about showing, I think the projection of Iowa poetry is very strong. People coming up are really good. And I think we have a lot of strength.
Now, you are also included in this collection as well. Would you read your poem for us? It's published in three different parts, and I know that you do need to modify because there's a word you can't say on the radio.
I know. I can't get bleeped. It would be terrible. So I did this thing with writing the land. It was I went down to Grade A Farms, which is an organic farm that's outside of Des Moines. And I did this series of pieces that ended up becoming this poem. And it's kind of confusing, but this is called a double exposure. That means that you're really, it's two poems, you're going back and forth between two poems. And so you'll have to, it'll make sense as I go. So this is called The Ravine and the Organic Farm. Beyond timber, discarded cars smoldered. Today, hay softened and saved garlic. Their bodies scattered like hidden boulders. Brome wandered to the edges of the crick. Tea kettles, ice boxes, rusted mattress springs. Morel mushrooms, wild ginger, columbine. Coils, coils of barbed wire, mason jar rings. Coneflowers, honeysuckle, and grapevines. Back then, refuse was erosion control. Now, buffers protect plants, hands pull burrs. Back then, fires melted tires, farms ate coal. Now, bundles of garlic cure from rafters. 2. Back then, soybeans, corn, cattle fattened. Now, sprouts started tended a month early. Till, 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 soil depleted and saddened. Garlic sold at farmer's market fairly. Hogs farrowed in filth, finished with paline. Recycle wood in the barn, unconcealed. Weeds eradicated with atrazine. Laying hens rotated from field to field. The old dictum of land was to subtract. New dictum is to replace, replenish. War drove weak men to rape and to ransack. Listening to the land provides pure grace. 3. Fouled oil poured out and gas tanks left to rot. Fawns asleep in tall grass undisturbed. Mud and manure stand shin-deep in the feedlot. Bees stockpile honey unperturbed. Soil blows from fields, corn wastes in the silo. Black locusts harvested for fence posts. Machines flattened like massive mastodons. Apple trees in fog are beautiful ghosts. To love something is not subjugation. To love something requires long-term concern, not rash return, not one generation. Children, water, apple trees, fawns, and ferns.
That is Paul Brook reading The Ravine and the Organic Farm, a double exposure contrasting two paradigms of farming. You also illustrate this poem with artwork, but also with some of your photographs as well. You did double exposure photographs. Maybe you could describe the fawn and the discarded pump photograph for us.
Yeah, I was interested in like how, well, I was thinking about how to write this poem, and then at the same time I was doing photographs of that farm, and I realized that I could like do some double exposures and lay like wildlife like over the top of like man-made objects. And I thought it was interesting. It sort of shows the dichotomy and the smashing together of like these two notions of like the natural and unnatural, or like the old school way of farming and the new school way of farming, right? So I'm just trying to show that kind of incongruity. And some of it's hard. These are hard lessons, right? We still are struggling with these issues. So, yep.
You brought all of these artists together in this collection, and now you will be bringing a lot of them together at Poetry Palooza. Have you all been in the same place before?
No, but we're going to have 24 of them reading and presenting
on
Saturday at 7 o'clock. It's 3 o'clock. It's going to be a madhouse, but it should be a lot of fun. And we're going to have them show their work and then talk through their artist's philosophy for the artists. And then each poet will read one poem, and then we'll do a signing afterwards. So it's going to be great fun. And to have like almost half of them there is going to be just magical.
Absolutely. So are they all the poets who are coming, or are some of the visual artists coming as well?
No,
and
no,
I know some of them are both.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, many are coming from both walks. So yeah, we're excited to have both sides of the equation here.
So Poetry Palooza obviously attracts people who are already excited about poetry. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about how to get new audiences excited about poetry. But I'll give you a chance. Paul, I'm sure you make this pitch to your students, too. What makes poetry essential?
I think it's just the connection to the human world and to making you think about something in a new way. And I think that that's so transformational. And I think that's foundational to the human experience. If you can move people, you know, in whatever capacity you're doing that. That's magic right there.
Bringing together all of these poets in this and artists in this collection, do you have a vision for the future? I know you were excited to create this collection, but you may just be building a community as well.
Oh, I sure hope so. That's the whole plan. I mean, we're going to do 10 readings across the state, and then many of these artists and poets need to have more attention given to their work, and that's the next plan.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for talking with me today, and congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Paul Brook, we were talking about the collection that he edited. It's called The Cities of the Plains, an anthology of Iowa artists and poets. We were also talking about his latest book of poetry. It's called Pantagruelian, Photographs and Poems of Torres del Paine. That is his sixth book of poetry. He is going to be all over the place at Poetry Palooza, including a book launch for the Cities of the Plains. That is going to be at 3 p.m. on Saturday at the Speed Lyceum at Grandview University. And of course, you can find out a whole lot more about Poetry Palooza in Des Moines online. It's happening on Friday and Saturday at Grandview University. Coming up in just a moment, we'll get some advice on how to get new and maybe even reluctant audiences excited about poetry. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.
This IPR podcast is supported by Cultivating Compassion, the Dr. Richard Deming Foundation, fostering causes that enrich the community, generate understanding, and cultivate compassion, including Above and Beyond Cancer.
It's Talk of Iowa from IPR News. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I promised you all poetry all the time this hour, but we know that not everyone is a poetry fan, something my next guest has some experience with. He also has some ideas for how to make poetry more accessible to new and even reluctant audiences. Seth Thill is a poet and a library assistant at the Waterloo Public Library. He recently gave a presentation on bringing poetry to new audiences at the Public Library Association Conference. Hello, Seth.
Hey, how are we doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here. And so let's start with you. You grew up in Dubuque. When did you first encounter poetry that you remember?
I did, yeah. So I came to poetry at a fairly young age, but kind of as a passerby. In third grade, I got really into Edgar Allan Poe and his poetry, which is what every parent wants their 8-year-old to be reading. But in third grade, that was the two library books I had checked out all year were the collected works of Edgar Allan Poe and a Peanuts like omnibus, like Snoopy and Charlie Brown cartoons. That was kind of my introduction to poetry, and I think I was more drawn to kind of like the mystique and everything of like Poe and how like weird and interesting it all seems.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of people who love Edgar Allan Poe who don't necessarily think that they love poetry.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that's a really big access point for a lot of people, and then I definitely kind of didn't head full on into poetry from there. Yeah, it kind of started with that specific kind of interest. But I would say probably in like seventh or eighth grade is when I really kind of came to it. And I always tell people, like, I didn't start writing poetry because I was reading Walt Whitman or whoever. Like, I came to poetry because I wanted to write like Slipknot songs and Metallica songs. So I very much came to it from poetry or from music and wanting to kind of like just finding some kind of outlet to express emotion, basically, and not playing a single instrument or knowing how to sing at that point in my life. So I was like, oh, well, I guess these are poems then instead. And then, from there, I think from like 13, 14 on, it really just kind of became my biggest kind of creative outlet and the thing that has kind of stuck with me the longest.
So you use your own experience in trying to help get students excited about poetry. But I think a lot of people doodle song lyrics in their notebooks. I know that I doodled song lyrics in my notebooks, although it wasn't Slipknot. Was there sort of an epiphany moment where you're like, oh, song lyrics are poetry?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was kind of, I think it was, I couldn't tell you a line of this poem any more. I don't remember anything about it, but it was, yeah, I think in seventh or eighth grade, I wrote a poem that was pretty much like note for note matching the meter of a, some Slipknot song. And that was like it. I wrote it as a song and then like just read it out. And I was like, oh, that like, I like that without music. I guess that's a poem. Like it really just came by like writing and writing certain things and then just eventually coming to them without music and just finally looking back on it. I think I wrote a lot of things initially without ever reading them again. And then I think when I actually started rereading the stuff that I wrote and just sitting with it for a little bit, I was like, oh, this feels like something else. This feels less like music and more like poetry.
In your experience at talking to people who may have a negative idea about poetry, I mean, a lot of people are introduced to poetry in school and don't like it for whatever reason. What do you think turns people off? What are some of the things that we've been doing wrong?
I think when I talk to people about poetry, I get a lot of like just that it's confusing or that it's only written by old dead white guys and like stuff like that. And I think that's just a matter of like people not coming to the poetry that they would identify with. I mean, there's such a vast, vast pool of poetry out there that's not just the, you know, your Whitmans, your Shakespeare's, stuff like that. But I think sometimes in school, and this wasn't necessarily my experience, but I think sometimes in school we get taught poetry, one, in a way that very much focuses on kind of the classics, the canonical authors. You're hitting an extra barrier there, one, just by needing to understand antiquated language. And then two, it's just you're not dealing with the issues that people are actually dealing with in those poems necessarily. I mean, a lot of it is like the universal themes of love and death and freedom and stuff like that. There's echoes throughout all of poetic history, I guess. But like, I find that not a lot of people get taught super contemporary poetry, or if they do, it's more contemporary than, again, like Shakespeare, but it's still not necessarily present day poetry. And
it really
so I just
resonates with their experience.
Yeah. I think it's just all about kind of being able to see yourself in the poem. And I think it's really hard to do that when you're reading things that are literally just in a different, like in an antiquated form of language. I also think poetry often can tend to get interpreted or even taught as like riddles, as like, as you know, you need to find the right meaning to a poem. And, you know, you have tests and English classes and stuff that are like these standardized have these standards that are like, you know, there's one right answer to interpreting this poem. Again, like, I don't know that I was necessarily taught in that way. I was very lucky to have really good teachers and then a pretty good education system. But like, I just feel a lot of times that makes people feel dumb is really right. What people have told me. Like,
if I can't understand it, then I'm stupid.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't think, like, one, people should never feel stupid, even if that was the goal of poetry, was to, like, solve this riddle. And two, like, that shouldn't be the point. Like, I think you don't have to map out some, like, some big, profound meaning out of something in the sense that, like, you're, again, taking these poetry lines as, like, riddles or anything. You can just sit with a poem and like enjoy the imagery and just kind of listen to what is being said if you're listening to it, or taking in what's being written and just enjoying the details and kind of sitting with the imagery of a poem, sitting with just the wordplay of a poem and how it sounds. I think poetry shouldn't be so rigid in the way that it sometimes can be interpreted or taught.
All right. So give me some advice. So knowing that a lot of people have been turned off to poetry in the past, or knowing that it's new to some people, although I think you've already pointed out that we all encounter poetry all the time in music. Definitely. Children's books are pure poetry a lot of the time as well, and something that was just part of life for so many children, and they may not realize that was also poetry. But tell me, so how do you like to approach poetry with a new audience?
So I think when I approach poetry with a new audience, I do the whole touchy feeling, like just let your feelings come out like that. But that really is all it needs to be, especially when you're just starting. You know, you can worry about those craft things. If you want to learn what a pantoum is 2 or 3 years down the line, you're more than welcome to, but you don't need to be figuring things like that out when you just start. I think when I teach poetry workshops that are more geared to like beginners or people who don't necessarily write a ton of poetry otherwise, the biggest things I say is first just spend some time observing, just write down everything that you observe. I think this works particularly great for like nature writing and things like that. But I think no matter where you are, just notice where you are and just kind of write down details and the things that feel significant or the things that feel profound. One, don't have to be these big, huge, profound things. Not every poem has to be a huge, super deep love poem or anything. But just write what is there. Like, write about what's around you. Write how you feel. Don't censor yourself, I guess, when you're coming out, when you're first starting to write poetry. Like, I am very much on the side of just writing everything you have, even today. I've been doing this in earnest for a decade or so. Even now, like when I'm writing a first draft of a poem, I don't edit as I go. I don't like censor things as I go or anything. I just write, censor in the most literal form of the word. But right. Just write and don't worry about whether it sounds smart. Because I don't think poetry ever has been or ever should be about being smart. It should be about you have this internal world inside of you, and that internal world matters and is full of possibility and is full of these weirdnesses that are super, super beautiful. And you just need to put those things on the page, and like, you don't have to think about, you don't have to rhyme, you don't have to have perfect, line breaks or anything like that right when you're starting. It's just, you have this internal world in you. It is constantly at odds with the external world. Like, you can explore that through poetry. You can just write and get those things on the page. Get those things into the world if you choose to share them. So just write what you feel and what you see, basically, is my biggest advice for anyone kind of coming to poetry as an outsider.
You also like to use music as a tool. It was your entryway to poetry. But how do you harness that for somebody who maybe hasn't made that connection?
Yeah, that's tricky. So when I teach, a lot of times it'll depend on the exact like subject I'm teaching a workshop on or whatever. But a lot of times I will just print out song lyrics from songs that either I like or I know are relatively popular, and just like look at these and just look at them on the page divorced from music. Like, I really think it's just like having that exposure and being able to look at it and just make those connections. I've even like, I'll put poems side by side on, or song lyrics side by side with a famous poem or something like that, and just compare the two. Cause I think it really is just like a perspective thing. I think like a lot of things that we talk about when we talk about poetry, it's just about finding the perspective that works for you.
When Bob Dylan won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2016, had you already started trying to do this with students, or did that predate this method for you?
2016, I actually think I was just starting college.
Okay, okay.
So I, Yeah, I came to UNI, actually, University of Northern Iowa, in 2016. So I think I was definitely starting to study poetry kind of in earnest for the first time around that time. And I definitely remember that time period because I wrote a paper on that, actually, like my senior year of college. I wrote a paper comparing poetry to lyricism, I think very much stemmed in the Bob Dylan Nobel Prize. Yeah.
Well, it definitely gives you credibility if anybody gives you any kind of a challenge on this. But I mean, when you're talking about lyrics to heavy metal songs being your inspiration, do you make an effort to try to reach the kids where they are at? I mean, you mentioned trying to embrace popular music of the moment, but yeah, it's also just what a kid cares about, right?
Definitely, yeah. So a lot of times, if the situation allows for it, I will try to let kids kind of I try to let kids find a song that they like and then kind of bring it. Sometimes not all settings are conducive to that if it's like a one-off 1 hour thing or something. I definitely try to. I don't listen to as much Slipknot as I used to. I will say that was my entry point into poetry. There is a poem about Slipknot in my chapbook that I wrote in 2022, but I don't really listen to a ton of that music anymore. So I do try to stay on top of like what people would actually connect with. And sometimes I don't know. Sometimes it's like, well, I haven't really paid attention to the world in a couple months. So I'm just going to do my best and whatever happens, happens. But I think people are, as long as they can kind of see that comparison made and something that they recognize, whether it's their favorite or not, I think usually that connection starts to happen regardless.
Well, and I know that memorizing poetry used to be a thing that we were supposed to do in schools. And it's something that, again, a lot of people find to be intimidating. But every single person has song lyrics memorized. So we all have internalized a poem at some point or another.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think this is an exercise I've ever done, but I would invite anyone to just like, yeah, whatever song you have stuck in your head, just like say it out loud. It'll probably sound really goofy, but depending on the song, I guess, but like just saying a song out loud and like feeling how the word, because even in songs, like we might not necessarily think of, well, I guess in a lot of music you do, but like there's that word play and just like rhythm. And obviously this is huge in like rap and hip hop music. But like even in like pop music, rock music or whatever, like there's a cadence to the words that comes through even if they aren't being sung. Like you're still going to get your alliteration. You're going to get, you know, those rhymes, I guess, though I said poetry doesn't have to rhyme. But I think even without literal music, it's really interesting to see how the music of the words kind of continues to make its way into the music. Yeah.
So, I mean, part of your argument is that we already love poetry, but for people who still are resistant, why do you feel like poetry is important and essential?
I think poetry is important and essential because I think a big problem that I see, particularly as someone who grew up in Dubuque in a working class family and community, I think when I see people or know people who kind of grew to be very bitter or kind of angry, for whatever legitimate or illegitimate reasons, I think a lot of people don't necessarily, I think a lot of that bitterness can be rooted in never having an outlet. Just kind of being trapped inside yourself.
It can give us a powerful outlet. Seth Thill, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Of course. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Seth Thill is a poet and library assistant at the Waterloo Public Library, and we'll go out with a little Metallica, which gave him his entree into poetry. This is Talk of Iowa from IPR News.